So this is 10 steps to a happier cloud app migration. So what does that mean? We don't know either, really.
Let's do the obligatory intros. So my name's Eric. I'm a PFE for Microsoft out of the Las Colinas, Dallas office. I would always much rather be skiing rather than doing pretty much anything else. It was very hard to hit my layover in Salt Lake and continue on to Las Vegas. But I'm here, and I'm happy, so we'll get through this. Thrill seeker, father, husband, and all that good stuff.
And I am Mark Rackley. I am also a father and a husband. I'm a developer, blogger, I'm a Pluralsight author, and I, of course, I'm a speaker.
Are you a hillbilly?
Well, there's a rumor around that I like bacon, and I am fairly fond of it. And I'm from Arkansas, so I'm a hillbilly. And my blog is also SharePointHillbilly.com, so it's kind of a theme there.
What's the difference?
Don't ask me what the difference between redneck and hillbilly.
What's the difference between redneck and hillbilly?
I don't know. I still don't know that.
All right, let's go into actually what we're going to be talking about. So what we hope to accomplish in this session, there's a lot of content. And what Mark and I like to do is, A, bring our hilarious antics, which hopefully you will all be laughing at or not, and bring it into a session where me as an IT pro and he as a developer kind of come together and attack these topics in those two different perspectives. So just so I know, how many people do we have that are IT pro-ish or fulfill that part of their role sometime? Oh, okay.
I might be outnumbered here. And the developers? No. We win.
not outnumbered. Okay, it's all right.
So yeah, but there's 10 steps here that we're going to cover. And to cover 10 steps in depth in 75 minutes, along with charming banter, is just not going to happen. So we're going to give you guys an overview of each of these steps. This is kind of like a flight of topics, if you will. And we're going to point you guys where you can go next, the next section you can go to get more in-depth information on these topics. And we do have a few demos in there, too.
Right. It's not fluff.
It's not
this
fluff.
This is full on.
Right.
We're just going to, there's some stuff that we can really dive into and some that we can't because we just don't have the time.
Right.
So hopefully what we do get into, you all will enjoy and find interesting.
Yes. Speaking of fluff, if you guys want a less technical session,
I didn't say that, Christian.
maybe less bacon and more bologna. Go check out Christian Buckley. He's a great guy, great speaker, and he has kind of a less technical session on what we'll be discussing today.
But if you want that pork chop or that steak, if you will, check out Bob German's session. He's going to be doing a lot more into deep dive some of the topics that we're talking about. So his session is going to be on Tuesday.
He's helping you how to build those solutions today so that when you go to the cloud, they're already ready to go to the cloud.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. So first thing is first. What we have to do is we have to sort of put into context cloud, right? So a lot of us, we're hearing a lot about cloud, and for some of us, the marketing message hasn't caught up to what features are available. And what we want to accomplish first is, from the Microsoft perspective, what cloud initiatives do you have available to you? And what does it mean? What features do you have available and that sort of thing? So we're going to go into, at least at a top level, these break down fairly deep as well, but at a top level, what sort of cloud options you have.
Right.
So the first, you have the private cloud. So this could be a couple of different things. The most common scenario is going to be you have, let's say, an organization that is governing your SharePoint environment, and they are giving you either a tenant or they're giving you just like a site collection. So at some level, someone has SharePoint on-prem installed somewhere, and they're dictating who has access. They're granting you storage. They might be charging your organization or your department for that usage. And that's what we kind of term as private cloud. So it's still on-prem, but you just sort of have a cut down access to it based on what your role is.
Like FPWeb or Rackspace.
Right. So that's a private cloud as well, right, if you have that full install. And we'll get into a little bit more of that too. So we know from just the fact that it's on-prem, we have the ability to do farm solutions, we have sandbox solutions. It's essentially what we've all been used to up until the advent of SharePoint Online. We know it can be expensive to run. We know that it can actually be expensive to maintain as well. And then, you know, again, depending on the scenarios and how it breaks down, who gets access to what and why they actually have that access will dictate costs as well. It's always been that traditional perspective. We know that as a new rev hits, we sort of expect that there's going to be some sort of new feature that we can either utilize to do better business transactions or just get better features. So every rev, we kind of expected that there's going to be a new something that we can do. And then we have Azure. So Azure is sort of Microsoft's, it rhymes with Badger, Mark.
Azure.
Right. Everyone take a drink every time Mark says Azure. So if you ever want to make sure you're not made fun of, Azure rhymes with Badger. We'll have to throw, that's one first tidbit of the day. So when you're looking at Azure, what is it? Right. So it can be a whole lot of things. It can fulfill different roles in SharePoint, and you can have little pieces and parts in there if you want. But at a top level, it's pretty much like Hyper-V or VMware for the cloud. Right? So it, at first, it seems very expensive. And you have to take into consideration where these expenses are going to be cut from. Right? So traditionally, we have a data center. We have servers. We have racks. We have contracts to manage that hardware. We have air conditioning costs. We have all these different things that go into managing our on-site data center or what we're actually contracting as a data center. That all goes away. Your content is now geolocated anywhere in the world in a couple different data centers, and you can control where that stuff gets served up. So it's a great solution for things like stretch farms for folks that don't have the bandwidth that would be jumping back to North America or something like that. Again, it seems really expensive. And the other part of the cost really comes from you have to understand how you're billed, and that sometimes can be kind of tricky. You're billed on consumption, storage-wise, but you're also billed on uptime. So if you have a VM that's running, you're billed on how much space that VM takes, as well as the fact that it's up. When it's turned off, you're only billed on how much storage is actually taking up. So those costs go into variations, too. You've been really quiet.
I have nothing to say.
It's sure to be coming. I'm just biting the bullet here. All right, so SharePoint Online. Up until today, we know some more things about this, and we've adjusted our deck as much as we could from this morning's conversation. But for the most part, we have what we have access to. And all that is dictated based on the license package that you purchase, E1, E2, business size, small business, E3, all those different things, as well as how many seats and what those seats actually need to do. Do they have to have access to Outlook and Link and all that sort of thing, and that goes into a larger package, or are we just talking just SharePoint Online? So for those who don't know, and it's sort of cloudy still, get that, anyone? Office 365 is a suite. I tell you, if it wasn't for our friends, we'd have no audience whatsoever. Office 365 is a suite. It's not just SharePoint, right? It's Exchange, it's AD, it's Link, and SharePoint Online. And I'm not sure how the OneDrive for Business fits into that. I'm not sure if it's a separate thing or if it's, whatever. But it's that's the role that we have for SharePoint Online and 365. So those are kind of the top three tiers, and again, they break out into different things. So let's do a demo. I'll go ahead and switch over here.
All right.
Well, let me set this up. So this takes about 25 minutes to do, so we had to record it. So I'm going to talk you through the recording. So there's some elapsed time that goes on, and I'll call that out. But what I wanted to do, especially for the IT pros in the room, and maybe for the devs, when you need to really understand where consumption and load balancing and all that stuff come into play, do you know what that means?
Consumption?
Load balancing?
Is that a disease?
Yeah. So this is my Azure portal. And we have a new feature available to us. In fact, it's really new. And my demo actually changed about midway through planning for this session to do this demo instead of one on affinity groups, which I think is also pretty cool. But we're going to do something called auto-scaling, right? So essentially what we're doing here at the end of this demo, you're going to see how in Azure you can have two web front ends. You know, we'll just use that for example for now. And we can bind that to conditions. And in that condition, we can say, once it hits this peak load for CPU or whatever, I want to spin up a second web front end. So distributing that load, but keeping it off until I actually need it. Totally hands off, you set it and forget it. Is that how that term goes?
Yes.
Set it and forget it. And what that allows us to do is it saves a ton of cost. Because again, remember, you're billed on consumption, amount of storage you're taking up, and you're also billed on when it's actually up. So let's go ahead and play the video. And I'll talk you through what's actually going on here.
Try to stay awake, devs.
Thanks. So I have two web front ends. Forget the naming convention. That's for another demo later. I have my SVC fail. That's my primary web front end. And I have web front end 2. So the first thing I need to do is I need to go into my web front ends and configure them, make sure that I can bind these to an auto-scaling group. So I have to make sure, A, they're both running, and B, they're both using the same resource package. So they're both using 3.5 gigs of memory and 2 cores. I'm going to create a new availability set here. I'm going to just go ahead and give it a name. Very clever naming convention here. And I'm going to go ahead and save it. And I'll get Mark's cursor off of there, so hopefully that goes away. Now, first thing I need to do is I need to say, or it's telling me, hey, you might restart your machine. Are you okay with that? Don't do this during the day, right? Do this at nighttime because you're probably going to recycle IIS and that sort of stuff. All right, so I've set that to an availability group, and that's really just 1/3 of the issue. So now Azure will take that and say, okay, I'm going to set these parameters that you've given me. I need to go and update your VM. I'm going to go ahead and drop it down, start it back up, and it's going to go back to a running state, which you can see there. Now I need to do basically the same exact thing for the web front end too. I need to bind that to the same availability group. Okay, so we'll do that. Riveting, I know. So we'll go in, again, make sure that we're bound to the same resource size. Now we don't have to create a new one. We can basically just pick the one we have, and we can see the machine that's already bound to that same availability group. So we'll hit save again, and it does the exact same thing. It'll knock that VM down, start it back up, update it, and you're back up and running.
That's awesome.
That is just fabulous, I'm sure. So now that we have those, we have to set some conditions on when these things actually go off. When my CPU load hits X, then I need to actually fire this thing going. So let's go into our cloud service, and that's where you manage the actual conditions for that availability group. So we'll go there. First thing, again, I want to make sure is the instances or the VMs, the web front ends, are up and running, because it's really important we have to make sure they're running. It's going to give us an alert saying it's not running and turn it on anyway, but we should just verify that they're actually up and running. So we'll go to our scaling. And now I want to say, okay, for demo SPC14, that availability set, I want to set some conditions on when this thing actually fires. So I'll give it a time, and you can make this whatever time you want. Peak load hours, 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock, or maybe at nighttime when you're doing crawling. You know, those sort of things you can go into a lot of different detail. For this one, I'll just do 12 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. And I will set it for my CPU load here. And I'm going to basically say, so that I make sure this actually goes off in my demo, that at 10%, this is going to fire and spin up my new demo. Or spin up my new web front end. And after that five minutes, so 5 minutes is the lowest interval that you can actually select to when that VM goes off, that's when I actually want to start that second VM. Then after 5 minutes goes by, where that CPU load drops below 10% in this case, I want to turn that VM off, right? So again, huge cost savings just in the availability to say, you know what, only turn on when I need you and turn off when I don't. So far,
that's,
so good?
I'm following it.
Okay, I'm glad.
Where's the code?
We're getting to that, don't worry. And then all the IT pros can fall asleep on yours.
Thanks.
Yeah? Okay, so what we'll notice when we set those conditions is web front end 2 will actually go stopped in a deallocated state, so I'm no longer paying for the running of that VM, just the storage is taking up. Okay? Now I actually want to provide some load against that machine to make this all happen, make this demo come together. So I'll log into my machine, and you'll have to excuse the trimmed down screenshots or the trimmed down video to make this all fit. You're going to see what I mean here in a second. You'll see just a little bit of the server. But basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to fire up my artificial load inhibitor or dehibitor. Inhibitor?
Inhibitor.
I'm creating load on my server. There we go. And I'm going to start my my performance monitor. So you can actually see that I'm going to do this in real time. And after that 5 minutes hits, then you'll actually see that web front end kicking up.
So what are we going to do for the 5 minutes while we wait?
Well, we're not going to wait. That's the beauty of video, right? We make sure that our demos never die, and you don't have to wait for the whole time. So again, this whole thing with provisioning, deprovisioning, setting up everything took about 26-ish minutes. So it's really quick. Yeah? You're going to have to wing it to the back row. That's the fun ones. All right, who's ready to catch? Oh, we did that last year with a 5-hour energy in a dark room. That was not a good idea. All right, so I've kicked off my load here, and you can see that I'm climbing steadily, 47, 50%, and it's just going to keep on going up. So once that's done, this is just people hitting the site, people are using it, etc. So after about 5 minutes and 37 seconds-ish, give or take a microsecond or two, you'll start to see the web front end fire up. Ignore the stopping of those other VMs. I think it's a UX issue. They don't actually stop, because one of the things in Azure is if you lose your domain controller right now, I know they're working on trying to come up with something a little bit better, you basically lose all your virtual IPs, and then everything can't connect again. So everything was working fine, so I know it didn't stop, but something on the screen was showing stopping. I don't know. So my web front ends are spinning up. And that's really the end of the demo. Yeah, so you'll see that it's actually up and running, and now I'm being able to span that load across two web front ends instead of one, and just, again, saving costs while I'm doing it.
That's amazing.
That is phenomenal.
And it didn't crash.
It didn't crash because I videoed it. Yeah. All right. And it's just showing the instances running. You can
get it. Good deal.
Fun stuff?
Yeah.
All right.
Switch it back over.
Yep.
So for more information, if you guys want more deep dive into this stuff, go see Kirk Evans and Brenda Carter. They have a session on Thursday at 9 a.m. And we'll make this slide deck available to you if we go through these dates and times too fast, or I think they're also making available to you at the conference,
yeah,
too. So
Kurt's like all about apps and Azure.
Make a Georgia joke about it, though, please.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So one of the bigger things we have to be concerned about is, again, we're always used to these different features that come with new versions of SharePoint. What do we have to be used to when we go to SharePoint Online, and what are some of the gaps that might cause us problems? So the first thing you have to worry about is, how are people going to be getting to content in SharePoint Online? So there's a whole bunch of ways that you can architect this. One way is you have your on-premise environment, and you have your SharePoint Online environment, and you're just giving people access to it externally to be able to interact at some level, but you also want your internal folks to be able to interact with those people and work with content in your SharePoint Online instance. And that's sort of what we're going at here with federation. So one of the things you have to have, and this sort of dictates costs, is you have to have at least a mid-size business plan. So there's mid-size, there's E1, E2, E3, and that's sort of how it works out. So you have to be at least on a mid-size. So these, the little, very small tenants, you're not going to be able to do federation in the first place. Also, E1 or higher for Yammer. So if you want Yammer and you want to integrate that and all the stuff that's been coming out with the keynote today and all the new stuff that's going to be talked about in this conference, you have to have E1 or higher. Is anyone using SharePoint Online exclusively right now? Exclusively, that's your whole SharePoint environment. Okay, so that's
that, you
know, probably about, I don't know, 15%, 20%?
No.
So the other big thing you have to worry about if you're going on-prem to SharePoint Online is, what's it going to cost? Right, that's always the biggest question, right? So here's a few tricks. A lot of the vendors, can we cut the recording for a minute? So a lot of the vendors, not a lot. There are some that use the exact same engine. There's only one API to get stuff up into SharePoint Online anyway, right? So a lot of them are using the exact same engine, and they're just branding it, or they're putting different features onto it. So you have to do the research into, A, how fast do I need my content in SharePoint Online, and B, how much of it do I need to move up there, right? So that's going to be the big question. Before in SharePoint on-premise, you could always say, you know what, forget it. I'm just going to move all my content databases over and just be done with it, and I'll just tell the site owners later to go clean up their stuff. And they never do, right? Let's be honest. But in SharePoint Online, you kind of have to, because you're going to be billed on both. So really take an effort to give people control of what they actually have to get rid of and how long it's actually going to take you to move up. You want to talk a little
Can
bit?
Can I talk for just a minute?
That would be awesome.
All right.
Yeah.
So you're going to hear us mention a few times, actually, that you don't have farm solutions in SharePoint Online. So you've got to kind of come to grips to that and have a strategy for what you're going to do with your current farm solutions. Also, you don't have any access to the file system as well. So things to keep in mind. And with that, if you have any third-party solutions installed that have to go through any kind of installation process on your servers, those are not going to migrate to the cloud either. They're not, so you're not going to be able to Office 365.
Right.
So a lot of those vendors will have Office 365 versions of their applications. Nintex is a great example of this. They've got on-premise workflow and forms, and they've got Office 365 workflow and forms. So if you're going to be having a lot of solutions, you want to see what your options are in Office 365. And for more information on kind of the no-code SPO stuff, what can I do?
The artist formerly known as Jennifer Mason.
Yeah, go check out Jennifer Mason Roth. Congratulations, Jennifer, if you're watching this.
She's not
and
watching.
Laura Rogers. Jennifer actually has a no semicolon campaign going, so I don't agree with that, but
well,
to say no to the semicolon, I think, is what her campaign is. So if you just see her say semicolon, that may sound weird. What? No, don't take the pledge. Say no to code. Okay, don't say no to code, right?
All right, so step three, we have to understand where this whole social thing is going for us, okay? So in your environment, what does social mean? And that means something totally different for every single person, every single organization, culture-wise, it all feeds into different things, right? So with on-premise, we know exactly what we're dealing with news feeds. We understand what news feeds are in SharePoint Online. They sort of work the same way. On-premise, we have to worry about, from the architecture perspective, okay, how many app servers are going to have to manage distributed cache, and how much RAM they're going to use, and can it be dynamic or static? By the way, all the questions are no for that. We know that there's right now, actually, did they announce that there's integration with Yammer? Does anyone know if they integration? Yeah, so they're talking about it. I don't know if it's been talked about or released yet, but ultimately, as of right now, when we built this, there was currently no migration for Yammer data.
Speaking of Yammer. So when I first started hearing about Yammer, I had the same thought as everybody else did, probably.
Facebook?
Why do we need Facebook for our work, right? We don't want people doing Facebook, right? So I've actually come around a little bit on this. I have a friend of mine who has a company, and they use Yammer exclusively for all their internal emails.
You have friends?
I've got two. And so, you know, this helps them in a lot of ways. They get some clear visibility between their delivery and their marketing and sales. They can see what's going on. When they bring in new employees, they can let the employees see what's going on, and it helps them come to speak quicker. And they also get an idea of what the culture is like for the company. So Microsoft is investing a lot of money in Yammer. They're really pushing it. And
that's,
you know,
an understatement.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a focus that this company, they have one of their corporate strategies is Yammer. So
definitely
check it out.
So then you have the none of the above strategy. And quite honestly, this is just not a strategy anymore. So in 2007, right, how many people said, I don't know about these My Sites. I don't think we're going to use them. Is it okay? I get this question all the time in 2007 instances. Is it okay if we don't use My Sites? And with 2007, technically yes. It was okay to not use My Sites, right? So you didn't really get anything by not having using them or by using them or not using them. It sort of totally depended on what you wanted to use it for. In 2010, that changed a little bit. So some of the feature sets would give us more enhanced functionality by using My Sites and feeding that data between those two. It is pretty much paramount now with on-premise 2013. It's not that you have to, but it's just that you really should, because if you don't, you're going to miss out on things like knowledge sourcing, or what do they call it, crowdsourcing of data, right? So when people find something interesting and they tag it and they rank it and that gets pushed up through the FAST architecture now, all these things now become super, super important as they tie back to the OneDrive stuff and your My Site stuff and just all the data that's being pushed around within Search and SharePoint 2013. So if you choose, say, you know what, we're not going to do My Sites in 2013, whether that be SharePoint Online or whether that be on-premise, you sort of have to understand that there's going to be features that you just don't get as a result, or usability issues that you're going to have as a result. We have a great session lined up, and I know that for a fact because I actually saw the content that Chris was putting together for this session. So when it comes time to say, okay, is Yammer the right tool for us and how do we measure that, this might be the session that you want to go to. So if you're a big proponent for Yammer and you're trying to push that in your organization, this is going to be a good one to check out on Thursday at 10:30. Yeah?
Absolutely.
BCS for the cloud?
SEC.
SEC? Anyone? No? Yeah? No one get that joke? Okay. Florida State was just a fluke. Don't worry about that. Okay, so there's, when you go SharePoint Online, there's a couple different things, again, that you have to be aware of, right? So a lot of the ways that content is being pushed around with BCS and how that gets bubbled up in apps is really going to be done through AppScope external content types. So where does this data come from? Can we pull it from SharePoint Online? Does it live in SharePoint Online? No, it lives external, and we have to pull all this stuff in. So there's quite a few steps to get that app or get that BCS data into SharePoint Online format to even be able to work with it within an app. So the first thing, among many, We have to create a WCF endpoint and make sure that we can expose that data source to even be able to work with it in the first place, right? So we're working sort of on-premise and SharePoint Online sort of in tandem. The other thing is we have to be able to use Visual Studio or that other tool that we won't really talk about to create external content types. You have to be able to create that content type. We have some people in the audience that are cringing at us right now for even not mentioning that content. And then you have to actually create or enhance your secure store service to be able to make those mappings come together, right? So if I want to be able to push that content from my endpoint and push that data up, I need some authentication in there, so that has to happen. And then finally, once you get all that done, then you can actually create an external list in SharePoint Online and consume that data and actually work with it as an external content type. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into this, and there's a lot of things you really need to be aware of when you're working with BCS data as of right now. Again, I know this is scheduled to change. Again, they're revving so fast that, in fact, some of the data actually went out of date on our deck when we put this together. So, right. But I do know a god of BCS. And if you know,
he's an Ohio State fan.
He is an Ohio State fan.
Come down from God's
status. So he's not quite God anymore. But we'll bring him down. He's very humble anyway, so he's not going to be taking that God stuff too seriously. But Todd Baginski and Michael Sherman, they have a session on BCS and business applications. Todd did a lot of the work for MCM for BCS. So if you have any questions BCS related, SharePoint Online or otherwise, he's the one you're going to want to talk to. Mark. Can you please talk for a little
while? Sure.
Thank you.
They're probably tired of hearing your voice anyway, right?
I need to make jokes because you're not doing a good job.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about search and navigation, okay? Maybe we can actually see something that's interesting for a change. So in 2013, you get a lot of new functionality with search navigation, all right? Don't hit anybody.
I won't.
Remember last time?
Who doesn't have a hat that wants to...
And what's really cool about search navigation is it allows you to aggregate data from all across your farm,
you
from multiple sites, and display that data to the users so they have no idea exactly where that data came from, right? So they may be seeing all the tasks for your entire farm and not necessarily know which site it came from, and they don't really care. They just want to know information about that task. And you can also create powerful filters so that you can actually filter that content coming back in your search by content type. So if I wanted to get all the tasks, I can use filter on the task content type. Kind of like the content query web part, except no more XSL. Who likes XSL? Really? All right. Obviously not developers, sorry. But you can now use display templates where you get to use HTML and JavaScript. So there's a lot you can do there.
How about a demo?
You want to actually see this, a demo?
Yeah.
Okay.
So while you're prepping this, I'll...
It's prepped. Push the button.
Oh, okay. You should tell them how fast this is going to go.
So yeah, so I also pre-recorded this because there's a lot of steps involved. I'm sorry, Lori, what?
You talking about content types, Lori?
Oh, she likes... Oh, and Lori Gowan's in our room, and she's got 1,000 people registered per session on content types. Go check that out.
I don't believe that. Who wants 1,000 people that want to hear about content types?
So anyway...
It must be Lori.
So here we have, here we are in our search center, and this is an on-premise farm. And you see these links in the middle of the page. This is search navigation. Okay, so users can come in here, they can click on the links to get the different search navigation. What we want to do is we want to add search navigation for tasks. So again, we can see all the tasks across our entire farm and find out what's going on with those.
Can I give stuff away?
You can give stuff away, yeah.
All right.
I got to talk for a little bit.
The only people that are bold enough to actually wear the hats.
So what we're going
to
do is we're going to add a page. And we're going to call the page tasks. And when we create it, sweet. Since we're in the search center, it adds some web parts for us automatically. We get the search box, we get the search navigation web part, we get the search results web part, and we also get a refinement web part, which lets us refine our search results. So we're going to go ahead, save this page. And now what we have to do is we need to add a link to the search navigation in the search settings so it actually appears as a link. So we're going to go into our site settings, and then we're going to go to the search settings.
No one wants to wear your hat.
That's fine.
No one's wearing it.
And here you see our links, and we're going to add another link for tasks. So let's go ahead and add a link.
You look like you could use a pick-me-up.
We'll call it tasks, and we'll give it the URL to that page we just created. We'll go ahead and save the page. And, oh.
I thought you recorded this.
I did record it. Let's look at the error.
Good job, Mark.
So, all right. Luckily, this is my on-premise farm, and I can actually go to the logs and see what happened. And it turns out that that page we created actually has to be checked in first before you add the search navigation link. So if you were on SharePoint Online and did that, you know, you may have no idea what happened. So let's go ahead and just check that page back in.
You did that on purpose.
I did that on purpose. You're right.
Crafty.
So we're going to publish that, and we're going to go through quickly. In fact, I'll speed up. Here is, we're going to add the link again.
Wow, you type so
I
fast.
Type fast. And now, bam, there we go. Wasn't that fast?
It's a good thing this is recorded.
Right. In fact, if I go past something too fast, you guys need to see something and say, whoa, and then I'll go back
whoa.
A little bit. Because I know it's fast. We've got limited time here. And you keep blabbing about stuff that doesn't make sense. So
that's the only value I bring to this whole session.
So what we're going to do now is edit the search results for this page. Well, we don't need the search box. So we're going to go ahead and just delete that because it's just getting in the way for what I want to do. But I'm going to edit the search results so that it only shows tasks for our farm. So we're going to edit the web part, and we're going to change the search criteria. Here in the property filter, I want to say that I want to find the content type that equals task. And when I test those results...
That's not going to work.
I get no results.
Yeah.
And I found this out, too, the hard way. So why don't I get results? Well, the query builder sets up content type equals content the content type's ID, which is actually not right. It should be content type equals the name of the content type, or content type ID equals the content type ID. So I'm going to change this real quick, and I'm going to do an SP content type to make it a little more accurate. We'll call it task, test our query, we're getting results back. We know our query is good. So we're going to go ahead and apply this. When we do, you'll see a list of all of our tasks.
Amazing demo.
Look at that. Okay, this is the demo. I'm done. No, but now we have a list of all the tasks from coming across through our search.
What is that text?
What's that?
The text.
The text, that's from Bacon Ipsum.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. But this isn't really helpful, right? It's the name of the task and a link to the task. You can't do a whole lot with that. So what we want to do is we want to create a display template so that it formats our data so it looks better, gives more information to the user, and adds more fields for the user. You can see here, if we switch back and forth from the different navigation links, it's taking us different pages. So now let's open up this page again. Let me show you where we specify what kind of display template we're going to use, or where you set those settings for content templates and display templates.
Can you make it prettier, too?
I'll make it prettier, too.
Thank you.
Right. So we're going to come here and edit the page. And if you look here, under the display templates, you have a control display template and an item display template. So that control display template is going to get executed once for the entire search result, and for each item, the item display template is going to get executed. So we're going to need to edit both of these templates. But we don't want to edit the ones that are there. We want to copy, maybe make a copy of one and edit it to our needs. Don't change what's there. So what we need to do is we need to go into the Design Manager. And since we're in our Search Center, if you go to the site settings, you'll see a link for Design Manager. And when you go to upload files, you'll see the URL for your master page gallery. Now you can either map this URL directly to your file system, or you can just browse to it, however you want to get there. But when you go to this master page gallery, you'll see a list of all your master pages. You see a folder for display templates, and that's where you want to go. And then you want to go into search. And here you see all of your display templates. And you see that each display template has a corresponding HTML file and a JavaScript file.
Tell me something about that JavaScript file.
When it's time.
Okay.
All right. This is the HTML file for the default control template, and that's the one we want to edit. That JavaScript file, which I'm going to tell you about now,
thank you,
is auto-generated. Do not mess with that JavaScript file. Don't edit it. Don't do anything to it. Leave it alone. Because when you upload a new HTML file, that JavaScript file will get generated for you, okay?
Think of it like a core file that you just never update. It keeps changing every time you rev a new version.
Right. And if you happen to be doing your master page gallery on another site collection other than your search center, those JavaScript files do not get generated in those master page galleries. So you actually have to upload those HTML files to your search center's master page gallery, get the generated JavaScript, and take that to your other site collections. Does that make sense? So we're going to download this control template after I push the play button. And we also need to download the item display template. And for that one, we're just going to use the default item HTML. So there's that one. We'll go ahead and download that. And then we need to open those up and edit them. So here we are. Can you guys see that okay? This is our control template. Oh. And as you can see, it's basically HTML and JavaScript. And the JavaScript is denoted by the pound sign underscore, the blue text, and then it closes off with another underscore pound sign. That's basically JavaScript in there. And then the rest of the stuff is HTML. So you can edit this. You can add your own JavaScript. You can add your own HTML. You can play with it to your heart's content. But what we need to find in this control template is where the items are actually generated. Where is that executed at? So we scroll down through all of this HTML. We find this CTX render groups. And this is where item template gets called. So this is where we need to put something around each item. And since I want to display this in something pretty, how about something like a table? Let's go ahead and put in then just some straight HTML for a table. So I've got a div that I'm going to apply some styling to, and then I've got a table. And our table has a column for tasks, status, the due date, and who the task is assigned to. And then we're going to call the render groups within that. So our render groups is going to create a row in that table. Everybody following?
Please take these hats. We can't return them. They look, this is his idea.
Last thing we need to do is we need to add a reference to our CSS. We do that by doing a little script in there, and we call the include CSS, and we give it the path to our CSS file, so we can actually get those styles applied to it. And finally, after we do that, we want to rename the template. We don't want to call it default result, because we want to be able to find it in that list. So we're going to call this task result. And then we're going to save the file, of course, as a different name. You can take two and give them to your kids. They'll love them. Now we want to edit the item template. We're going to call this one task item.
Daddy, mommy, who's on this hat? They're scary.
Let's also rename the ID and give it something unique. But as we look at the item display template, this is much more simple. There's much less code here, right? And you see here we have this CTX render body. And that's where the item is getting rendered on the page. And that's what we want to overwrite. So we're going to put some HTML in here. As you can see, we're just going to put in a table row. So we have our TRs, and we're going to do a cell. And with that cell, we're going to have a link that has the title, task, formatted date, and the assigned to. And that dot title, dot task status, dot assigned to, those are managed properties, okay? And those managed properties have to exist to be displayed in your search results. We also have a couple of JavaScript functions. I've got this one called getDueDateStyle, which will do some date calculations to find out if the task is late, if it's on time, if it's almost late, so we can just apply some color coding to that. And then a simple JavaScript function for formatting the date so it looks nice.
Beautiful.
Isn't it? So up the top here, we have our managed properties. Remember I said that title and assigned to and task status, that's all managed properties? Well, we now have to specify in this managed property mapping that we're using those managed properties. So let's add those. We've got due date, the assigned to, and task status. So we're going to add those to the property mapping of the file. We're going to save the file. And now we're going to upload those HTML files back to the master page gallery. And you'll see after that is done for both of those, that will actually create that JavaScript file for us, because we didn't create that JS file, we just edited the HTML file.
Nice.
And there we see the JavaScript file gets created. Now, after you've uploaded your item template, you need to go to your search results types. This is something I found after banging my head against the wall saying, why is this not working, why is this not working? You need to go to your search results. And at the top of that, you'll say, hey, we need to do a property sync. You uploaded a new item display template with new managed properties. We need to know about that. So you come in here to your search results, do an update, and then you're fine. After I hit that little update, after banging my head for a day, there were all my results. I'm like, oh, lovely. So now that we've done that, next thing we need to do is we need to start a crawl. right? Because we got to crawl those properties. Actually, we got to add the managed properties first. That's right. So we map those managed properties and say, I want to add them. Well, now they have to actually exist.
I'm waiting for the pretty stuff.
We're getting there. So we go into our search schema within our search settings of central administration, and the assigned to managed property already exists. But if you look at the assigned to, it's not specified as searchable, refinable, or sortable. It needs to be so it gets returned back. So we got to go in there and edit that managed property.
Watch how fast he clicks.
And we're making it searchable, refinable, and sortable. And now we need to add managed property for due date. Okay? And this, again, is pretty fast. It's a date and time. It's searchable, queryable, retrievable. We'll call it refinable and sortable. Now that we have added it, we have to map it to a crawled property. Managed property is mapped to a crawled property, okay? Which is crawled by search. Since we're doing it for due date, let's find out the crawled property we have. We have OWS due date. So that's what we want to map it to. We'll save that. We'll do the same thing for task status. We're going to create the managed property called task status, which is text. It's searchable, queryable, refinable, sortable. And we're going to map that to OWS underscore status. Now, this is the biggest difference between on-premise and Office 365. In Office 365, you cannot create a managed property that is anything but text or yes/no. You can't create a date time, you can't create an integer, you can't create any of that. What they've done in Office 365 is they've created a set of placeholder managed properties. They're called refinable date time, refinable string, refinable integer. You need to find those managed properties and then map them to the crawled property you care about, okay? A little extra information for free there. So now after you've added all those managed properties, we do have to start the crawl so that those properties will be crawled. Again, in Office 365, you can't start a crawl. You can just request that your site be reindexed, which could take, what, 24 hours? No? I've seen it, okay. Lori says no. I believe Lori, because she's doing a session on content types. So now we're going to edit our tasks page again, and we're going to specify those templates that we created. So let's edit the page.
This is the pretty part, right?
Almost.
Okay.
We're going to set the control template as task result. It shows up automatically since we uploaded it. And our item template we're going to set to task item. And once we apply that, hey, look, it looks a little prettier.
Hey, it's prettier.
Yeah. Woohoo, it actually worked. But it's recorded, so of course it's going to work. Hey, thank you. So now we can see the tasks. We can click on the task to get to it. We know the status of the task, who it's assigned to, when it's due, and then we know by color coding if it's late or on time or whatever. So this is for all the tasks across our farm. That's pretty cool. And on the left-hand side, you can even refine that information. So I can say, I only want to see the tasks assigned to the tasks that are deferred. So now it filters it and only shows the tasks that are deferred. I want to see the ones that are assigned to me. So now I see all the deferred tasks that are assigned to me. Really quick. You saw how quick that was. I mean, this is really cool. You can also do some sorting. So I want to see the newest ones, the oldest ones. I can sort it by due date. This is really cool stuff. So that is search navigation with the search results.
Nice.
Yeah. And you want to go ahead and click over there?
Sure will.
If you want more information on this, you can see Mr. Jennifer Mason's Corey Ross session. And he has a whole session on this. And he's actually going to use the content search results web part. I did not use that web part because it's only available in E3 and above, so you don't get it below E3.
Laura, we pitched someone else's because you already have 1,000 people. Sorry. All right. So let's talk about step 6. I can't believe she gave out all those hats.
All of them?
You don't have to return any of them. Good job. These hats mean something, by the way.
Right, talk.
Well, yeah, I got time. Hold on. We'll make that more apparent at the end, because we're not going to expect you to walk around with these. Well, sort of. All right, so OneDrive for Business. That has changed as of today. So we heard this morning that we're actually going to have a standalone OneDrive for Business in Office 365. So we have that to also take into consideration, right? You got a waving hand right here. If you can make it out that way, you got to tie it in a knot. I'll be really impressed by you. All that bacon's going to come into play right now. All right, so With OneDrive, the biggest thing we have to worry about here, or at least that we have access to, that was terrible. We have the ability, so we have a couple different OneDrives, right? So one today, how many drives are there?
Three drives. There's two OneDrives.
Three OneDrives now. There's one for business, one for personal, but they can live in different places now, right? So we have Office 365, but we also have on-prem.
It's OneDrive squared.
Yeah. So anyway, point is, wherever you choose to keep this data, we have made some APIs available to you so that you can actually build apps to integrate with that data, work with it, manipulate it, pull it, show it, do different things with either client-side object model or the REST API. So if you haven't fallen in love with the REST API, I know you love CSOM. I love REST.
No, I'm a REST fan.
I'm not a developer.
I'm a REST fan.
There's a bunch of different sessions on this, but the one that we're going to talk about is going to be Rob Howard's. He's got one, tomorrow. He's got one on building apps using OneDrive, integrating with that data, and then building apps, you know, specifically for your organization. So that's going to be a really good session to check out as well. How about some BI?
BI. So as developers, we probably don't care about BI at all, do we? Right? I mean, this is business.
You should.
Yeah. Well, you don't really. Well, traditionally BI.
Traditionally, you should. Shouldn't?
Can I talk?
Sure.
Traditionally, BI is reporting services and performance point. And, you know, those are still valid solutions. They've been enhanced also for 2013, but those are on-premise only solutions. And with traditional BI, you get static report definitions, right? You have someone in business saying, I need a report that shows how much money we spent on bacon last year. And you give it to your developer writes the report, and they can run that report whenever they want to. Right? It's a static report. Not very helpful sometimes. And let's face it, how is the majority of our BI done today?
I love Excel.
So I think I give the answer, but yeah, Excel. Everybody's using Excel.
That was a joke. That's terrible.
They export their data to Excel. They
all
change it how they want.
All 3,000 columns, right? Let's import all 3,000 columns.
And they complain when it's slow, but they're doing it all in Excel. So Microsoft, they actually listened here, and they're like, you know what? This is the way people are doing this stuff. Let's actually help them do that. So they came up with Power BI. And now with Power BI, you can actually use Excel. You can start with Excel, like we're all doing anyway. And you can connect it to internal and public data sources and create your workbooks in Excel. And then you upload those to SharePoint online. And there's this magical thing called the Data Management Gateway, which syncs your data between on-premise and the cloud. And then your reports in Power BI work like search. So if you say, I want to know how much money Microsoft spent on bacon in 2012, and it will actually generate that report data as you type in the results. See, I didn't know much about this before this session, actually. I'm like, wow, this is really cool.
Right, so now it's forcing people to use a function like search more intuitively that they're always used to using and just typing out exactly what their query is.
I think that's what I just said.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to clarify for the non-developers in the room.
All right, some of the caveats of Power BI, it is Office 365 only. That's not going to change, is it? And there's an additional cost, that's not going to change, is it? Okay, so that's not going to change. This is for Matt Brimmer, and he would know. And, you know, I have a demo. I was going to show this to him. Like, this is really cool stuff, and I heard about their demo today at the keynote. And I'm like, well, this demo's just not near as cool. But still, just in case you haven't seen it, here we have a Power BI site, and you can see we're just going to type in a query. What is the medal count? This is for Olympics. What's the medal count for the USA? There were 2,500 medals. Okay, what about the USA versus Russia? Let's see what that is. Give us a little map of those countries. We can say, well, I want to see the actual number. 428 to 249, 2492. What about with Norway? Let's add Norway to the mix. So you can keep adding on to your results, and you can see those results. You can get charts of those results. So I want a pie chart. Magically, it appears.
Poor Norway.
As if by magic. You can, let's say I just want to see the medal count for USA by gender. Let's see if that works. And there you can see it. We got the medal count for men, women, and mixed.
Hey, he didn't.
How about by sport? So here's the medal count by sport. I mean, it's really cool the kind of different data and results you can get by just typing in the query. I say, man, I want to do just for archery. Hurry up, typer. So here's archery by gender. And so you can get that information. So you kind of get an idea there just for the cool stuff you get. I mean, it's pretty cool, right? It's not as cool as maybe the demo they did today at the keynote. I'm sorry, I didn't know. They didn't ask me if they were going to.
I still like it.
All right, appreciate it. So the man for Power BI is Mr. John White. So if you want to know more, go check out his session. He has the coolest blog title in the world, The White Pages. How cool is that? Makes SharePoint Hillbilly sound pretty lame, right?
Didn't take John White's name to make that sound.
I appreciate that. Okay. So you IT pros may be wondering, with all this push to the cloud, do I still have a job?
Of course you still have a job. There's always those fears, right? Every time something changes, there's always those fears. So here's where you guys come into play. So from the IT pro perspective, depending on which cloud you go to, right? So let's talk Azure here for a second. Everything is the same. Everything that you did before, maybe you have to know a little bit more about virtual networking, but even that is way easier to do just in an Azure portal than, say, in Hyper-V or in VMware. So if you're used to that, you're already set. Everything you've done before, it's just you're remoting into a cloud-based VM. You can't even tell the difference if you're remoting in there or you're remoting into the data center right down the hall. Right? So everything is still the same. It's all on-premise. So depending on which way your organization goes, that's what you're looking at. If you're looking at SharePoint Online, another sort of role that you can take on if you choose to do so, and you might have to, is going to be that data strategist, right? So the person building those reports, putting that data in there, making sure that the business can get the data that they need when they actually need it, whether it's using Power BI, whether it's just populating content the way we need to actually do our business, right? So you will still also have all the things that came with a SharePoint administrator. We also have, if you guys didn't know this already, PowerShell. We've kind of been pushing this for a long time, right? So PowerShell in late 2007, that version, we were still kind of starting to talk about this. In 2010, we were like, hey, definitely check out PowerShell. In 2013, we were basically saying, if you're not doing it, you're probably not using SharePoint to its fullest potential. Gary, the point's over there, just nod his head, yep. You now have the ability to take PowerShell, and through some of the commandlets that we've sort of exposed to you, you are now allowing yourself to be to PowerShell directly against your tenant and manipulate certain things. And the different things that you can manipulate are based on the package, so that will all sort of dictate what you have the ability to do. But things like spinning up new sites, crushing sites, users, adding users, taking users away, a lot of different stuff that you can do with PowerShell. So you're still going to be super, super valuable. Don't even get those fears in your head. It's silly, right? So let's just keep moving forward, keep adjusting our skill sets, and just adding more as we go forward.
And are they going to add more commandlets, Matt? Are they going to add more commandlets?
Yeah. Okay. He knew everything else. Why didn't he?
Yeah, you should know.
All right, so if you want to know more about how you can manipulate SharePoint Online through PowerShell and just other different methods, you can check out Chris his session on Wednesday at 10:15 on just managing SharePoint Online through all those different topics that we just talked about. Cool.
Very good.
Thank you.
Can I talk again?
Sure.
So now let's talk about your development hurdles you're going to face as developers, right? So if you're in Azure, if you're in Azure, you can still use your farm solutions, right? Those still work if you're up there because you've got full access to the system, so you can add those to your heart's content. Sandbox solutions, you can still use those as well. You know, if you're going from 2010 to 2013, you may have to do some rebuilding of your solutions, but it's not a monumental effort in this, is it, Sean? It's not monumental. He's done it a lot. And you also have SharePoint apps now, right? So you can access the App Store, you can use these apps in Office 365 or in your on-premise farm, so that gives you a lot of cool flexibility there as well. So if you're on Office 365, you may have heard me say this once or twice, farm solutions are not an option. They're just not. You need to embrace the app model. And then after that, you need to embrace the app model.
Points for trying.
You have zero access to that file system. Keep that in mind. For sandbox solutions, code is officially deprecated. It still works. You can still upload your sandbox solutions to Office 365, and they will work. They're not guaranteed to work forever, though. They could suddenly cut off support for it at any moment, although the ASMX web services have been deprecated for how many years now, Mark? Three? How many years have the ASMX web services been deprecated? They've been deprecated for a while.
I just changed a slide on you.
All right, but the XML is still supported. So you can do custom actions and anything with XML as sandbox solutions, and that's still totally supported. Then you have, again, SharePoint apps, right? Between on-premise and Office 365, your SharePoint apps are going to help you out both ways there. So definitely, again, learn about SharePoint apps. When it comes to SharePoint apps, you've got a few different options. You have, I was looking at the presenter slide, I was freaking out. You have provider-hosted apps, and these can be, you know, anything you want, any technology you want. And I think that's all you're saying. If you've got PHP developers, they can now start writing SharePoint apps, right? You can do Java, who cares the technology? You're running on your own little web server, and they are, and you can get those created. Sorry. Excuse me. You also have auto-hosted apps. And these are spun up in Azure for you.
Good job.
Sorry, I'm working on it. But these still aren't quite ready for prime time. It's in beta. It's in pre-release. It's for testing. It's for testing? The official word is it's for testing. This is not the app you're looking for, all right? And then you have your SharePoint-hosted apps. And I really like SharePoint-hosted apps. They're really cool. I mean, this is, I don't know, once you start getting the SharePoint-hosted apps, it really opens up a lot of different options for development. You'll be surprised what you can do with those. And it's all client-side development, so the only big caveat there is you can't elevate permissions. So if you need to elevate permissions, you can't do it with a SharePoint-hosted app. So tip for you guys is to start using client-side dev now, no matter what. No matter if you're on 2007, 2010, or 2013, start using client-side dev. In 2010, they had a REST and CSOM library, which really cool. 2013, those libraries exploded. And now, I mean, there's just so much functionality. You can create workflows with CSOM. You can create sites, list libraries, you can create content types. I mean, the amount of things you can't do is getting less and less and less. And there's also a library called SP Services. Anybody use SP Services? Yeah, so the author of SP Services is here. Won't you stand up? Come on, Mark, stand up. There you go. And that library works in 2007, 2010, or 2013. And there's also a lot of resources available out there for client-side dev. You've got jQuery, you've got a ton of other third-party libraries, and you've got this new tool called TypeScript. And TypeScript is, you call it JavaScript for .NET developers, I think is what you call it? For professional developers. No, it's for .NET developers, not professional developers. Stand up, Matt Bremer. This is his session tomorrow.
Man, or when is it?
When's your session? 10:45.
There is a lot of ego building in this session. I'm just saying.
I got to get my scores up somehow.
Not yours.
And there's a lot of rapidly maturing practices. So there's these tools called Angular and Breeze. Any of you guys using that? So with Angular, you now get MVVM in client-side in JavaScript, which is pretty cool. And with Breeze, you get client-side data caching. And you can actually do link queries against that data. So it's like real development now. It's like professional developers are doing it, right? So you also get this new thing called single-page apps. And when you start doing a single-page app, which is basically, just like the name implies, your entire application takes place in one page. The user never navigates away from that page. So there's all the changes take place in that one page. So when you take into account the patterns and practices, Angular, Breeze, SPAs, and SharePoint-hosted apps, that's awesome sauce right there. I mean, that's just really cool stuff. I did just say that, sorry. Right. Don't judge me.
I don't need a joke at all. I mean, you just made it yourself.
What's that? Okay, thank you. So Andrew Connell, let me know who Andrew Connell is. He has a blog coming out very soon on AngularJS and Breeze and SPAs, so check that out. He also has a Pluralsight course coming out on it, so it's really awesome sauce. And he's actually worked with the Breeze people to get a SharePoint library created so that it does all your data connections for you, does all your REST queries for you, so you don't have to expand on anything or filter or search. It's really cool. All right. So when you're going to client-side dev, your scripts are going to migrate well because of the limited changes in 2007, 2010, and 2013. A lot of those scripts will just migrate over without a problem. However, be careful of changes that Microsoft may be introducing, right? They had recently decided to change the way they're going to render the title attribute on their pages.
I don't like your tone.
It ended up breaking a lot of scripts, and it made a lot of people angry, including Mr. Anderson here. No, you're angry. You said some really bad words. Okay, he's disappointed. So if your scripts stop working magically without notice, take a look and see if Microsoft changed what they were doing to the DOM. Hopefully that's not going to happen again, because I think there's a lot of stuff got said during that, and I think they learned their lesson on that one. So criticism was heard. They actually heard. And then there's this great feature in Office 365 called the minimal download strategy. I say great, and I mean not great. Actually, this is created so that whenever...
I didn't know my own strength.
Right. So minimal download strategy is a feature that was created so that to increase your performance of your pages so that only the parts of your page that change get loaded. However, in Office 365, if you've got minimal download strategy activated, a lot of your scripts will stop working. They just will not get loaded. This includes custom action scripts. So if you go to your site features, you can just disable minimal download strategy. If you see underscore layouts 15 start ASPX in your URL, that means it's using minimal download strategy. You have anything to add to that, Matt? Okay. So let's go see a demo on this now. And also, here's a URL to some code I have on GitHub. And within that code, I've got some client-side scripts you can play with. I've also got a Visual Studio solution for a SharePoint-hosted spa using Angular. Doesn't use Breeze, because I didn't know about Breeze at that point. But you guys can get in there, play with it, see how it works. Works fairly well.
We're going to tweet a link to the demo, or to our deck. So if you haven't wrote this down quick enough.
Right.
Literally right after.
So let's do a demo, and we'll do a demo with some client-side dev.
Are we doing this live?
This demo is actually live.
We're doing it live.
Yeah. So if it breaks, it's my fault. Actually, it's SharePoint's fault.
It's pretty much always your fault.
So here we have a list of contracts, okay? Nothing fancy. And let's go and edit one of the properties for one of these documents. And here we have our standard SharePoint edit form. Lots and lots of scrolling. Data is not organized very well. If you select a vendor, it doesn't filter those products. It only shows the products for that vendor. It still shows all the products. Right? This is not a very usable form, but this is the way the default edit forms work in SharePoint. This is why a lot of users go to things like Nintex or went to things like InfoPath before it died. And sorry, was that a little too excited about that? So, but you can... Sorry, Lori. She likes InfoPath too. But what you can do is you can use some client-side dev. You can add it directly to this page without affecting SharePoint or hurting SharePoint at all. You can make this page look and function a lot better. So that's what we're going to do here. So here in SharePoint Designer, which I do use for some of my scripts.
Cool, man.
I have two scripts that I have loaded.
It's free.
I've heard
you
it's free.
Go download it right now.
It is free. I have two scripts I've created. I've created an HTML file, which, can you guys see that? So I've got an HTML file that I'm going to use to add some more style to that page. So it's got some tabs. I'm using jQuery UI to create some tabs. I'm adding some coloring, so it's going to look better, and it's going to organize our data better. This is just straight HTML. So you could give this to your designers who actually can do HTML, because I'm not a designer. Say, create me something pretty, and they'll come back and create you something pretty. Then I've got a JavaScript file. In this JavaScript file, I'm referencing jQuery. I'm referencing jQuery UI for those tabs. And I've got some style sheets I'm accessing. And this script is also getting applied to the page to add some other user functionality to it. So we're going to style the page, and we're going to add some functionality to it. If you guys want some more detail on this script, you can actually go to a blog. I've got several blogs on this. This is kind of how I do a lot of my bread and butter right now. I like it. It's quick and dirty. It doesn't hurt your farm at all. People like it. Makes it pretty. So anyway, I've got these two scripts, and I'm going to add these scripts to this form. So we're going to go to the contracts library. We're going to go to the ribbon, and we are going to edit the default edit form. And we're going to add a couple of content editor web parts. Don't judge me.
Way before content editor web parts do.
Another web part, content editor. And now we're going to link to those two scripts from our site assets directory. So we're going to edit this web part. We're going to link it to site assets / new contract.js. We'll apply that. And now we're going to add that HTML to the other content editor web part. You could have both of these in the same script if you wanted to, but I like to just separate my display logic from my script. And that was site assets / contract form .html. So let's apply that. Here you see it as tabs. So go ahead and stop editing this. Let's open it back up so we can look at it. So now we have that same contract form, that same information. I didn't change the list. I didn't deploy any solutions. I haven't hurt the performance of our farm. I'm not going to have an admin yelling at me because I didn't dispose of something I was supposed to dispose of. And the user gets their data in a much more organized fashion. I've got the vendor information here, payment information, the business owners. And I'm doing things also, I'm using some REST, so that when you select a vendor, it only loads those products or services for that vendor. So now the users don't have to figure out, well, which product or service is this supposed to be for? I've also done things like, well, if this contract is a master services agreement, I hide the master services agreement field because you shouldn't be selecting it if it is a master services agreement. So doing things like this, you can see how we can add functionality to our forms. We can stop users from making user mistakes and make them look a lot better. And this is without anything like InfoPath or anything else like that. So, start embracing client-side dev today.
Indeed.
So for more information, and this session I really actually want to go to myself, Steve Walker and Vesa, they have a session on Wednesday. And what they're going to do is they're going to take a full trust solution and they're going to convert it to the client, the cloud app model. So that is going to be really awesome. And they just released yesterday the solution pack with their code. So, I mean, I'm going to be there. It should be an awesome session.
Yeah. All right, step 10, full circle. Let's bring it back down. So with step 10, and we're looking at hybrid and private clouds, this is probably going to change, right? So going forward, basically 29% of the folks who are going to be using cloud, this was a poll done, I think, mid-year last year, 29% of those folks are going to be planning a hybrid solution with cloud. So it's either going to be some on-prem, it's either going to be a little bit on-prem, a little bit SharePoint Online, maybe it's using Azure for federation of AD synchronization and all that sort of thing. So when you're looking at this from an IT pro slash admin architect perspective, you need to start thinking about, okay, well, how can I federate with Office 365? So depending on how you choose to do it, so there's a couple of different ways. Again, I talked about you have your on-prem instance. You can totally go into Azure and have your entire on-prem instance there where you're doing your federation of Active Directory services there. Or you can have all of your stuff within SharePoint Online. You still, at some level or another, you have to have a component that you're going to be using for Active Directory synchronization, right? So there's a couple different ways to handle it, but really from the talking points that we really want to talk about here is just the different types of scenarios where you may want to use a hybrid deployment of SharePoint and SharePoint Online. The two that I come up with, and these are actually really, really recent, two different scenarios. One, a customer who is a college and they have thousands and thousands and thousands of students and alumni, previous students, people that have gone on, gotten jobs at the college, just a lot of people that they have to manage, right? So a good hybrid solution here would be, okay, so I have my SharePoint Online instance where I can have all those external users coming in, authenticating with their Windows ID. I don't have to manage any of those accounts. They don't go against any of my internal AD CALs that I have to manage. But I also have the ability for my internal folks to interact with those people and those students externally. So maybe you have a professor who is running a class and there's some thesis things that they have to work on or some collaboration as a team. And they can do all that within SharePoint Online. And you as an IT organization, you don't have to manage any of that from an account perspective. You just have to make sure that the federation's there and can take place. The other scenario that I like to put out there is the scenario of external contractors. So I have another customer who is a home builder. So this home builder, they have all these different contractors that are not part of that company, but they're subcontractors, basically. They have to be able to share plans, upload neighborhood schematics, and just all the blueprints that go along with building homes. You can imagine there's a lot of overhead to make sure that people are collaborating. Well, those contractors, they hire people, they let people go, they scale up, they scale down based on economy. That can be a nightmare for any IT organization to manage in real time. So that's another really good scenario for using a hybrid deployment. So again, you have some level of integration and interaction within the cloud, and then you have your normal on-prem environment. And again, that's right now where a lot of people are sort of finding the sweet spot. I think ultimately, as a lot of the new features get pushed to SharePoint Online, and that becomes the old way to do it, so SharePoint on-premise, doesn't have as many features as SharePoint Online, then maybe someday that'll sort of fade out. But who knows? As of right now, a lot of people are going hybrid. If you want to know more about hybrid, look at that. He's so happy there. Check out Spence's session Tuesday, 9 a.m., which I'm kind of bummed about because my second session is during this and I really wanted to check it out, so I'll have to check the recording. But he's going to be doing a session on Active Directory synchronization in Azure. So that first scenario that I talked about where you have sort of your on-prem environment either on-prem in your data center or in Azure, and then federating that with SharePoint Online. So that's going to be a great session. Definitely check that out.
Right, sum it up. You know, you're going to see these slides a lot in all the dev sessions this conference. And really, just start checking out what they've come out with, the new contextual apps, the new APIs, and their new tools they're coming out with. So definitely check out the API. Connect with the community and build using our tools.
So the one thing that we'll actually kind of leave you all with, go Jeff, the high five random midair.
Yeah.
He's playing a video game. So I like this one better. So the hats. So that's technically the end of our session. That was very anticlimactic, right? So thank you all for joining us. However, the hats, right? So yeah, they're cheesy.
They are.
But
they're supposed to be.
But what that means, so if you, we have probably $600 or $700 worth of Starbucks cards. I'm totally lying. There's like maybe $50 worth. If you find us and you're wearing the hats, stop us. You can't be putting it on and then walking because we see that. We already saw it once. You have to own it. Thank God there's no more left that I don't have to wear any of them. I'm kidding. I have mine. I'll wear it. But yeah, find us. We'll give you a Starbucks card if we have any left starting in 3 hours. Don't hit me up as soon as we walk out.
Right.
Anyway, thank you all for joining us. Hopefully you had a good time. Appreciate it.